Okay, let's take a few minutes. So let yourself get into a comfortable position and just relax your body. And take some deep breaths. Just let all the muscles relax. And relax your mind. Relax your mind in this way. Bring in the inner friend, the non-judgmental witness, and allow your mind to just simply be. Not asking it to think anything in particular, to feel anything in particular. Just let yourself relax the mind by enjoying it and not trying to control it in any way. No clinging. That's hard to do if there's a judgmental person inside or a critical person. If you think about in the world, if you're near a critical person, or if you know that there's somebody in the universe at this moment who's critical of you, that creates stress. So by bringing in that non-judgmental friend, that part of you that can appreciate and love your own mind. That holds yourself in positive regard. That loving, non-judgmental, interested atmosphere. Allows the mind to relax. And the non-judgmental, caring part of yourself can even be that way toward the critical part, toward all parts. So all parts of the mind are just simply allowed to be as they are. And you simply abide as the non-judgmental witness. And that's what allows the mind to relax. You're not directing it. You're not controlling it. You're simply providing an atmosphere that it can allow it to be as it is without fear. Nothing to do, nothing to accomplish. It's fine as it is. if there's hurt or worry or agitation there. See if you can just be present to that without trying to control it. As though just simply relax into it. Be with it as a friend. Without trying to control your mind and just simply allowing your body and mind to be relaxed and to be as they are. Just notice your own presence and the steadiness of your presence. Sensations of the body, whatever thoughts in the mind are there, whatever feelings are there. Take place and are known, they're illumined by your own presence. They're not covering you in any way. You're present to those experiences. And you are still. And always the same. Your presence is what makes all experiences meaningful. Your being is what is dear and what is most important. The thoughts, the perceptions, the sensations, rotate around you in a sense. Once your mind discovers that, then the mind has a home. A stable home. A strong and benign presence. It is changelessly there. Om Sahana Vavatu, Sahana Punaktu, Saha Viryam Karavavahai, Tejasvina Patitamastu Mabhidvishavahai. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. We say Jnana Nishtha means person who is really rooted in their knowledge, means their mind is totally living up to their knowledge. There's no conflict there. What you know, what your buddhi knows, what you've understood at the time of teaching, the whole mind has integrated that. Right? And so that the mind itself has integrated all the deep recesses of the mind, so there's not little parts of the mind that are off on their own. Because your buddhi means the intellect, or the part that really has understood this knowledge. Right? That one's not chasing after the mind. Right? So we call that jnana nishtha, being rooted in the knowledge. And that jnana nishtha is often equated with vairagya, or vairagya is equated with jnana nishtha, where vairagya means dispassion, this word dispassion, that often in spiritual groups can have kind of a negative connotation, where dispassion means, you know, you're not supposed to want anything, you're not supposed to have any type of a desire. In fact, it can even be negative, where you don't want, you don't like things. It can go that far. Or if you like anything or have a desire for anything, then you don't have vairagya. So everything should be awful. And that's an extreme, right? That's an extreme reaction. But what the example that Swamiji and I actually always tell for vairagya, because I think it's so clear, is just like for the dispassion that a that an adult has for a helium balloon that's going up in the sky is a totally different relationship than a child's relationship with that helium balloon. It's totally different, right? For a child, that's really bad. That's a tragedy. And that balloon unfortunately slips off the finger. But, you know, for an adult, it's interesting. It's not a tragedy at all. It's interesting. You have lost the balloon, but you can enjoy the flight of the balloon, etc. But the difference is between you and the little child is that in your mind, there is no projection of happiness, of your well-being upon the balloon. It's not there. If it were there, then you also, even though you're an adult, you would also be feeling very unhappy when the balloon was released. But for most of us, our well-being is really not attached to the helium balloon. It doesn't matter at all. Now, when it doesn't matter at all, we can have fun with the balloon. We can enjoy it. We can do things with it. Engage in play around it. Think it's great. All of these things. You have all of these feelings. It can be fun. The difference is your well-being is not dependent on its presence or its absence. So the thing to understand there is that the fact that your well-being is not at all dependent on the presence or absence of the balloon says nothing about whether you can like the balloon or have fun with the balloon or do things with the balloon or get engaged with the balloon and think the balloon is great. You can have all kinds of relationships with the balloon. The only thing is, your well-being is not at all at stake. And for a child, when they're engaging with the balloon, they're having fun with it and in relationship with it and doing all kinds of things with it. But it's not going to be the same when they lose the balloon, right? Because their happiness was so much attached to the balloon that they can't enjoy that loss. It's not even a matter of enjoyment. It's a matter of that's what's happening. It can't really be like that, usually, for a child. Because it's more than just having fun with the balloon. The balloon is my source of happiness. And we can all really understand what vairagya is in reference to a balloon. It's easy for us to understand that. And understand how much freedom there is. You know, like people, I remember that often people have asked the question, well, if I were to gain this knowledge, say if I were to gain vairagya toward everything, you know, how would I still love my partner? Would I still love my children? Would I still enjoy life? Right? Would I be able to engage in life? Would I even want to live? Why would I even want to live? And I say it's actually so much the opposite. You're actually given an opportunity to live very freely, just like you can engage with the balloon and have a good time with the balloon, because there's no fear there. You know? If you think that you need that object to be happy, you can't really be happy in the presence of that object. It's not possible, you know, because the object, any object, is like a balloon. In the long run, right? Any object, any relationship has a balloon-like quality. And that is that it can be lost, it can change, it will go away. And no matter how secure your relationship is, or your love life is, or your love for your child, no matter how secure it is, it's not that secure. Doesn't matter how it could be the most secure. It's not that secure. Because there isn't anything that's not subject to change, and there's nothing that's not subject to death. And the psyche knows that. Right? And so to the degree that you love, to that degree also you carry some sorrow. Right? And so for a person who has self-knowledge, jnana-nishtha, that vairagya is equated to that jnana-nishtha, because for that person, everything is truly like a balloon, like the helium balloon. Everything. Your body, your mind, your sense organs, your relationships, all beings, the creation, everything is like a balloon. And that doesn't mean that you don't love it, that you don't enjoy it, that you don't have preferences. You know? It means only that your ananda, that your wholeness, is simply not at stake. Now, how can you say that? How it seems like it's going too far. You know? And in a way, it is going too far. But in a way, it's not going too far at all. And this is why. As you gain knowledge, so I'm assuming a certain level of knowledge here. But as you gain knowledge, you are actually recognizing the nature of yourself. The nature of yourself, the conscious being that you are, is not being changed or altered by any state of mind. Your conscious me, this me that's sitting here, the I, right? No matter what type of a thought modification that you're having, this I is not being altered. So say, for instance, a thought modification comes along. This is what we're talking jnana-nishtha here. Thought modification comes along that is sorrowful. Because, I'll make something up, someone who is very dear to you, your mother or your father or your loved one, somebody was hurt or somebody died. And so there is a sorrowful thought. A thought of grief comes, right? Which is warranted by that relationship. Right? Because you had a love for somebody, somebody's hurt, you know? And so that relationship warrants a feeling of grief, right? And you have jnana-nishtha. Do you think that a feeling of sadness couldn't come? And if a feeling of sadness does come, do you become sad? This is really, it's a beautiful thing to understand. The feeling of sad, say a tragedy has happened, a feeling of sadness or sorrow or sympathy or some sort of emotion comes. You illumine that emotion. The emotion is there and you are there. You're always the same. An emotion, a thought, a feeling, it never changes you whether you know that or not. Whether you have knowledge or not, it doesn't change the reality. But for a mind that has knowledge, yourself is the constant being that is present no matter what the thought is. Okay, so now, say because of a tragedy, a thought of sorrow or grief or sadness comes. For the jnani, what does the buddhi do, the intellect, that one who has knowledge, you, the one who has knowledge, the mind? How does the mind relate to that thought of sorrow? Does the mind say, for the jnani, oh, I am so sorrowful? Is that even how the mind of the jnani would think? Oh, I'm so sorrowful. I don't think so. That's not how, at all how one would relate to that experience. They would say that for a jnani to have that experience of sorrow or grief in a given situation would be appropriate to the situation. And then you would just appreciate the appropriateness of the sorrow. It's not that I am sorrowful, or woe is me, or why did this happen to me? That type of thinking, I can't see being there. That type of build-up upon the emotion. But the emotion will be there because the emotion is deserved. The emotion is appropriate. But then how do you relate to the emotion? You know? That's what's so important to understand. It's not as though being a human being, you don't have appropriate emotions to situations. But then what do you do with those particular situations? What do you do with those particular emotions? Say there's no buildup. And there's no buildup because, number one, in your experience of sorrow, the experience of sorrow doesn't give the self an experience of sorrow. There's an experience of sorrow. Your self remains the same. So your self then is containing that experience of sorrow. The buddhi, your mind, your intellect, the one who has knowledge, right, then is responding to that experience of sorrow. From what vantage point? From the vantage point of your knowledge. And so your self is always stable. It's not responding to anything. It's the very being that is pervasive to all experience. And your knowledge is responding to the experiences that you have. So think like this. You have a mind and you have sense organs. You have relationship with the world that is ongoing. Right? There's nothing you can do about that. Just like right now, because your sense organs are open, you're going to be receiving all kinds of input. So it's coming in. So you're not going to stop that. Say you're walking down the street. You're in the middle of San Francisco. Right? You're going to be taking in all kinds of stuff. You turn on the television, have a conversation with anybody. There's activity going on galore. Right? All kinds of vrittis. Vrittis means thought modifications, coming and going. Right? It's really like Grand Central Station, all that's coming in. And you can't. And that's going to be that way as long as you have the sense organs. Right? As long as you have a mind, as long as you're alive. So the sense organs are coming, the thoughts are coming and going and coming and going, many of which you have no say over as long as your sense organs are open, right? They're coming in. So now the question is, how does your mind, how does your knowledge, right, relate to it? Do you relate to all of this, the input, including your own feelings and your own emotions and your own reactions from the standpoint of knowledge? Or do you relate to it from the standpoint of ignorance? For jnani, somebody of jnana nishtha, they relate to everything that happens, including everything that happens in your own mind, from the standpoint of knowledge. That's why it's so important to me at that time, you know, many years ago when Swamiji said, we were talking about the mind, and he said, even my mind has all kinds of funny things. And he laughed. And what he meant was, the mind does all kinds of funny things. Here we are, receiving thousands of vrittis, thousands of thought modifications all of the time, thousands of interactions. They're coming and going, coming and going. How are you with those? And does your buddhi, your knowledge, has it assimilated your experience, and is its relationship with your being inviolate? And by that I mean, has your mind had the opportunity to recognize your own presence? The presence of yourself. Has it recognized the presence of yourself? The one who is always changelessly present, no matter what the mind is doing. If it's recognized the presence of yourself and differentiated it from itself, then your buddhi is always at home. Right? Because your mind, buddhi, your intellect, your mind, but I'm talking now from the standpoint of your knowledge, it can never be away from home. It can never be away from yourself. It's just that yourself doesn't change, and it does, right? It has thought modification after thought modification after thought modification, but those thought modifications are never away from your being. So in the Upanishads, they say, you know, if you send your mind to the moon, and send your mind to the moon, the self is already there. Right? Wherever your mind goes, you're already there. It cannot go away. It can't escape you. And so once your mind has differentiated your being, the constancy of your being from itself, then it rests there. It has a home. That's what I mean by a home. The mind has a home. It has you. Now in this mind, the buddhi, the intellect, gains knowledge. I say the intellect because that's the part of the mind, the aspect of the mind that is able to know, right? Where ignorance is removed, the one who knows, that has a shining light, with a running commentary on those things that take place. It's the one that would say, will judge or evaluate or understand experience. And so that's where the knowledge is being held in the buddhi. Okay. And so that buddhi is never away from the self, and that buddhi, if it is clear, once it has clarity, it is the friend to whatever experience is going on, including whatever experiences are going on in your mind. And when that's the situation, there's never a sense of you being away from yourself, nor is there a sense that your mind has to be a particular way. Because if your mind, this is what the buddhi is there, because if your mind is behaving in a particular way, that's interesting to you. Like say your mind is reacting about something. That's interesting. It's like the time, I've told this story, when Swamiji once was trying to light a match. It was a book of matches, and he was trying to light it in one hand. He'd seen some 007 or somebody do that, or heard about it somehow. So he had this book of matches, and he was trying to do this with one hand. And as he was trying to do it, somehow the whole book exploded, on fire, like that. And he was really startled. And he wasn't really used to being startled. So he thought, he didn't think, oh my God, I don't have any knowledge because I was startled. But he thought, wow, that's interesting. I was startled. And so he kind of played around with it for a while because he didn't really like the idea that he was startled. And he was thinking, well, he wanted to kind of master that. That, you know, kind of like a... like if you're playing tennis or something and you want to get your stroke better, he wanted to kind of master this being startled. He found it interesting, right? So that's how your buddhi is. You find life interesting. Ishvara is infinite. Ishvara means the Lord, the whole creation. It's infinite. There are infinite possibilities. Something happens, your mind behaves in a certain way that is unusual for you, or interesting, or something that you want to tweak because you don't really want it to be that way. You know, it's not that I've become unhappy. I might want to tweak something. I might want to change something. I might want to mature in a particular way. I might want my mind to grow in certain capacities. Maybe I want to become more kind. Maybe I don't want to react in this particular way. It's not that I've become unhappy or not complete. Or not whole. It's that, oh, this is interesting. I would like to improve this particular thing. Or if it doesn't bother me, then I don't need to improve it. I mean, there's billions of things we could improve. You're not going to go around improving everything. You know, so you improve those things that you want to improve. And you leave a lot of things alone also. But whether you're improving or not I must not have my cell phone. Kristen, it's 325-1471. I don't know why that happened. Anyway, I've got it on tape, so I'll put it online. And so we're just getting to where I'm going with this is now. When we teach, like in a guided meditation or in talks like this, bringing in that inner friend or that inner attitude, right? This is a practice that we do, you know, that actually becomes absolutely natural as you know yourself. As you gain knowledge of yourself, of that constant one who is completely benign, as the mind gains vairagya, all of these type of things, then that attitude toward all experience is interesting, including all of your experience, all of your mental experience, all of your emotional experience. It's interesting and part of Ishwara. And some things you may want to change, and some things you don't need to change, right? But the point is that for somebody who's beyond initiative, your being is not at stake, and it's not lost, right? Your wholeness is not lost. You don't have that feeling that I need this to be happy. That's beyond initiative. You don't have that feeling, oh, my mind has to be like this in order for me to be happy. Oh, I had that kind of thought. I can't be happy if I have that kind of thought. That kind of thinking is not there because yourself is stable. Okay. Now, until you have that jnana nishtha, that rootedness in your knowledge, then you practice. There's certain practices that you can do that kind of fall into the realm of karma yoga that actually give you, in a sense, the same result in terms of your mind, in terms of your peace of mind, as jnana nishtha does. And so that's why Krishna in the Bhagavad Gita, Lord Krishna talks so much about karma yoga. You have to understand what he means by karma yoga and what it does for your mind. Because it's a certain attitude that allows you, it's an attitude that allows you to have those desires that go kind of like this. Say when you have knowledge, you're gaining knowledge and you're getting some clarity. I know that this is how it goes. I know that my own being is really the one and only source of happiness. I know that when my mind is quiet and full, it reflects that. I understand all of that, but I still need that to make me happy. I still want that. I still have to have that, even though I know all this. You know, because it takes a while, you know, some years or some months, some years for most of us. Years. I'm one of the years people. It takes time for the mind to, all the different parts of the mind to say, oh wow, I really don't need anything at all to be happy, and whatever is there is fine. And in fact, in terms of my prarabdha, the karmas that caused me to take this birth, I can count on those karmas giving me whatever it is that I really need. Whatever I really need as a human being, the prarabdha karmas will fulfill that for me. Right? So I get at all times exactly what is there basic for me, what really belongs to me, moment by moment by moment. And I don't really need anything else because there is really, in truth, no other source of ananda or fullness except for my own being. It's just that when my mind becomes quiet, that fullness of myself reflects in the mind to give me the experience of happiness. And when I fulfill desires, I get a calm mind for a moment, and so I think that object has made me happy. That's the illusion. At some point, I know that. And so then, this life that I've been given, these people that I've been given, this situation that I've been given, I own as mine, and I can live here in my life and enjoy it, because I don't think that if I only had this set of objects, that would make all the difference. But until I have grown and matured in my knowledge, we can practice karma yoga that gives me exactly, in a sense, the same type of shanti, the same type of peace that then I can enjoy as I grow into my knowledge, as I give myself time to assimilate. And this is how the Lord really presents karma yoga. It's the whole Bhagavad Gita. And it's basically this understanding. You go ahead and be responsible for your actions and for fulfilling your desires. I want this or I want that. Say you want this. Whatever it is, I need this. I want this. I have a desire for this. Then you go for it. Completely. You go for that desire. It's just the only thing is that accept the results of your actions. You take actions in order to fulfill that desire. Accept the results of your actions as prasad from me. The Lord, Ishwar, the Lord talking. You accept it as prasad. And so, this is the idea. When you, in India, when you go to a temple, you will participate in the puja. The pujari will be doing all of the puja. And then at the end of the puja, the pujari, the priest, will come out and offer you some prasad. Now that prasad, it's an offering from the Lord. Right? It says, though Ishwara, in prasad, Ishwara, the Lord is giving you a blessing, is giving you something. And so often that prasadam, it could be like some drops of water that were used in the ritual, or it could be some sandalwood, or it could be even some little petals of flowers, or it could be some laddus, some sweets, or it could even be a whole banana leaf of food. It could be a full meal. There's it goes from clear from a full meal on a banana leaf to maybe a little basket of rice, or a laddu, or sweets, or several sweets, or just some water, or some flower petals, or some chandas, or some just vibhuti, some ash. Could be any of these things. But whatever it is, the devotees are always there to receive it like this, And when the flower petals are given, then they're never thrown on the floor. You always just go like this. You put to your eyes, and then you'll put it behind your ear, or you'll keep it. Something sacred. Or if it's water, you'll put it, Whatever it is, never would a devotee say, I don't want water. Aren't there any lettuce? It doesn't happen. That's what we mean by prasadam. You take it as from Ishwara. And then that allows, that attitude, right, gives you peace. Because that means that you are in relationship with the Lord. Right? And the results of all of your actions are taken as that prasadam. You could be interested in it, or that's interesting. And then if you really want something, you can try again. And maybe, the result won't be what you wanted again. And maybe again it won't be. But your buddhi, the buddhi is karma yoga. Means everything that you receive, you take as prasadam. And at the same time, you have the freedom to do the action. So in the most famous verse that Lord Krishna says, just you be responsible for the action. Let me be responsible for the result. Know that you are responsible for the action. I am responsible for the result. Always take the result as prasadam for me. And so if we have that attitude, it's a tremendous relief for the mind. Right? And it's a way to handle your mind and your desires. That's what it is. You know, if we say to our mind, oh, you're not supposed to have any desires. Well, if it's not supposed to have any desires, why does it then? Why does it? How to be with those desires? Some desires you can say, you know, that's just like you would tell a child, I know you have this desire, but I don't think we want to go for it. But we have a reason for that, right? You have a desire, and that's a whole different ballgame. You have a desire, you make a determination. You, the adult you, makes a determination. I really want this, but it's not in my best interest. When you make that decision, you're making that decision for a greater desire, right? You give up a smaller desire for a greater desire. See what I mean? We sacrifice like that all the time. We choose something, one desire over another. If I do this in the long run, that won't bless me as much as not doing it. So I still have the same desire. But we have this, do you see what I'm saying there? But we have, so we make a decision there not to do that. That's fine. But what about the desires that you do have, that there's no reason not to have that desire, except that the desire causes you pain? It's not that there's something wrong with the desire in itself. It's what's wrong, what's causing the problem, is that if I don't fulfill that desire, I'll be miserable. So what's wrong is the projection of the ananda, of the happiness, on the object of desire. That's the problem, right? And so what if I can't say, well, what if I say like that? Yes, I know that. That's the problem. And I still want it. Then you can say, yes, you want it, good. You go for it. But let the results of it be prasadam for me, from the Ishwara. There's another thing to understand in this too that is really important. For a human being, you live your life from the birth to death, right? That's your prarabdha karma, right? Certain karmas are fructifying from the past, from the sanchitta. They are now fructifying to cause you to take this birth with this your set of parents, the era that you were born into, the major experiences that you've had. You're going to have a whole story unfolding from birth to death. And now, as the story unfolds, the story of your life unfolds, what actually draws you into your life from, you know, moment to moment to moment? Well, it's desire. They say three things. Either the desires of somebody else are going to pull you into something, right? Or your own desires will pull you into something. I want to do this, right? If somebody else wants you to do it, or you want to do it. There's a third thing, is what we call anicca. Nobody's desiring it. It's just the way the universe is unfolding, and everybody kind of gets sucked into it. It's not that somebody's pulling you, or that you are instigating it, but just the group karma is unfolding in such a way that you find yourself in that situation. But the important point here is what we call swecha, your own desires. Your own desires are part of the prarabdha karma. You're not going to end up, whether you're a jivan mukta, right, a liberated person, living liberated, or a samsari. Either way, you're going to have desires. The desires that belong to your prarabdha karma that push you through your life. Right? The difference is, for a jnani, one who has self-knowledge, it's that I have the desire, but it's what we call a dugdha bija. It's a burnt seed. Because I want to do this, but if it doesn't work out, my ananda is not dependent on it. If it works out, that's fine, right? If the desire isn't fulfilled, that's also fine. I would rather have it be fulfilled. But in terms of my dependence, the dependence of my well-being be dependent on it, it isn't. Whether it's prarabdha or not, it doesn't make any difference. Because myself is not dependent on the prarabdha karma. It's not dependent upon the happy events. It's not dependent upon the sad events. And my mind knows that, right? So So since my mind knows that, there's a twofold gain. The one gain is that my own being is always the same and it's recognized. It's its own light. It's not dependent upon any thought or any state of mind. Once I know, that's it. Right? And then the secondary gain is that my mind has recognized this. My mind has recognized I am the source of the happiness, not the world. Right? The world is not giving it to me. No, Ishwar is not giving it to me. Nobody's giving it to me. I am it. The Ananda of which is my being. Right? My being is that source. And my being is Ishwara. Right? My being is the self of Ishwara. There's not two Ishwaras here. There's not two selves. Right? And so when that's the case, the Jivan Mukta is independent of Ishwara also. In terms of dependence on for happiness. I don't have to say, I can say, Ishwara, please help me, please help me to fulfill a desire. There's nothing wrong with that. But even Ishwara cannot take away myself. Even the Lord cannot take away myself. The Lord can't take away His self. Brahman is not take-awayable. Right? The Atma, your being, nobody can take it away. Ishwara can't take it away. You can't take it away. Nobody can take it. It can't take itself away. And so that's what freedom is. That's what freedom is. Nobody can take it away. Ishwara can't take it away. You can't take it away. Nobody can do anything about it. You can't make it worse, and you can't make it better. Nor is there any way to make it better or to even conceive of making it better. There's no way to even conceive of making your being better because it's too whole as it is. It's not something that you can even conceive of. And so once that self is known, you're free. Who's free? Your mind is free. Yourself has always been free. There's never a problem for the Atma, for you. You have always been free. You always will be free. You always will be as you are. So when we say who's free, it's the mind is free because the mind recognizes that I'm always free. Right? And the mind was bound, right? Because it didn't know that. It was never bound. The self has never been bound. But the mind didn't know that, and the mind says, I am the self and I am bound. That was the mistake. It's not that, this is another thing. It's not that the mind was stupid or made a mistake. It didn't make a mistake, right? It's that it is bound by ignorance until that ignorance is removed. So that mistake is a beginningless mistake that's born of ignorance. Right? But fortunately, there's knowledge. Right? And knowledge removes ignorance. Once that ignorance is removed, it doesn't come back. You know, if you think of the rope snake, where somebody's walking along and they mistake a rope for a snake. That's all very real. All of your response is going to be very real to that. Especially if you think you were bitten or something. You have all the emotional expense. That's a reality. Until you see the rope. And then you can't get that snake back. You can teach about it. You can talk about it. You can remember that you had mistaken it. Right? You can remember it. But you can't make that happen again. You know, it's not possible. In that instance, the whole snake disappears and you see the rope. In this instance, the whole creation doesn't disappear. Right, that's a little bit different. The whole creation doesn't disappear. But the internal projections do disappear. Right? The fact is that yourself, the conscious being, your own being, right, is always the same. That's an experiential fact. The ignorance that has caused you to superimpose the changelessness of your being on the changing mind can be removed. When it's removed, you can't get that ignorance back. It's not possible. You can't all of a sudden become changing again. Right? Your mind can have some time, lag time, in terms of continuing to desire this and continuing to desire that and continuing to think in this way and think in that way. But it's thinking in these ridiculous ways, blessed by my changeless self. Right? With my changeless being, the being that is me, present, the mind behaves in interestingly ignorant ways. And as I gain jnana nishtha, what happens is the clarity of my buddhi, the clarity of my knowledge, then greets these what I would call extraordinary behaviors or natural behaviors or emotionally lag time behaviors. And it's not a problem. Right? Once myself is really recognized, then knowledge keeps becoming more and more clear around the relationship. Who is Ishwara? What is this creation? What is this body, mind, sense organs? What is it doing? You know, what are all of these interrelationships? How does it all work? That clarity keeps growing and growing and growing until the mind becomes settled. It becomes settled as a mind. It understands what it is as a mind. Right? It understands what knowledge is. It understands what ignorance is. It understands what the body is. It understands what the creation is. It understands what Ishwara is. It understands all of these relationships, and it relaxes in that. That clarity keeps increasing and increasing and increasing. But at some point, I've recognized myself. And then that self is not in clarity. It doesn't increase and increase and increase. Myself is myself. It doesn't have a bunch of parts. It doesn't have a right side or a left side. It doesn't have, you know, it doesn't change. It doesn't change. So once you know you, you know you. But then this jnanam with pratibandhikas, you know, these what we call obstructions, is the clarity in relationship to the jiva's relationship to Ishwara and the jiva's relationship to the world. You know, so the mind understands and knows and settles down. It becomes at peace. The mind wants to know. Remember, you probably remember when you were a little child or a teenager praying to God, God, what's going on? What is this? In any mumukshu, is going to have, at some point in your life, you're going to have wanted to know, what is this? Why am I here? What is this creation? Who? What is Ishwara? What is the Lord? Is there a Lord? What is all of this about? You want to know. The mind wants to know. It wants clarity. You know, and it wants clarity. Somebody can't just come and say, boom, 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 be clear. You know, it itself, the mind itself has to be clear. It has to understand and know. It has to have its questions answered. You know, it has to have the freedom to ask and to become settled. And so then when it knows, it can live here. Right? And rest in this knowledge. That's how maturity takes place. Well, in the meantime, there's ways of being in the world. There's ways of having desires, you know, that allow, there's an attitudes with which to have your desires. And those, with having those desires with those particular attitudes that we call karma yoga, brings about what we call an antakarana shuddhi, purity of mind. It means a mind that's not in pain, a mind that's at rest, and that at peace, the mind that has peace. And then that mind goes on maturing in light of its understanding. Maturing and understanding are together. So that's where this vairagya and karma yoga come in together. You know, if you're there at vairagya, as that vairagya develops, the karma yoga is not really necessary because everything's Ishwara. Everything's Ishwara, so you don't worry about it. But as that vairagya is developing, because as it develops, you know, then your mind is just sitting with an Ishwara, and yourself is always the same. So it's not an issue. This Ishwara is fine. This set of things is fine. It's Bhagavan. It's not a problem. So that kartritvam, that doership, I have to do this, I have to do that to become happy, that goes away, and then you just engage in the world as the person that you are. So there's no conflict there. But until all of that clarity is there, then there's that karma yoga. That then means you're actively relating, you're fulfilling your desires, but you're actively relating to the world as Ishvara. I want this. Let me have this. Oh, you don't want me to have this? Okay, well, this is good. Prasad. See what I mean? It's very nice. Okay, let's just take a minute. Om Purnamidah Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vasishyate Om Shanti Shanti Shanti.
Vairagya. It has the word rag in it. And from what I understand, ragdvesha.
Ragdvesha.
Is like.
Likes and dislikes.
Yeah. And what?
Ragadvesha.
Yeah. So, like, when even in the story of the Buddha, you know, here it, the story was that he was a prince and was given everything because of the prediction. His father wanted him to be a worldly prince.
Yeah.
But the prediction was he could be either. So he escapes from the beautiful playpen that his father built for him.
Yeah.
And he goes out in the world and he sees sickness, basically sees
death and poverty.
He sees, well, all the things that in some ways we have dvesha for, poverty, sickness, and death. So I was, what struck me was, in the experience of the practice, because is there sort of a different, how does one, in practicing this teaching, is there a difference in the quality of our relationship with these two things? In that, do we see...
Well, Raga...
You develop a certain kind of a change in polarity where the things that might be very attractive to people, such as money and fame and all that, end up being in some ways less desirable.
Well, actually, yes. I think that they do become less desirable, not because they're money or wealth, but just because one doesn't tend to have strong desires for things because you already feel complete inside. So there's not going to be the same type of desire. If you're feeling full and complete or whole, then to have a really strong desire for something in order to become happy is not really theirs. It becomes a little different. But say, Say we look at raga and dvesha. Raga means likes and dvesha, dislikes. They're really two sides of the same coin. I want this so I can be happy. That's a raga. That's the desire template. I want this so I can be happy. The dvesha is, I don't want this so I can be happy. They're the same, right? It's just saying the same thing negatively. Get rid of this so I can be happy. Get this so I can be happy. Mm-hmm. And that intensity around manipulating the world, let me have it this way or that way or this way, goes away when you are fine with how it is. You don't have to have it this way and you don't have to have it that way. And so, yeah, that type of intensity is probably not there as much. But then that doesn't mean at all that you don't enjoy things or that you don't prefer things to be one way or another. It's just that your well-being isn't at stake, and that just changes kind of the way that the mind is in response to the world. You respond differently if you're not at stake than if you are.
What I understood is a slightly different slant. It's more like once you understand you're the whole, you're not the body-mind identified individual, then any action is really more towards that whole. So if I say, I want to do something for myself, I want to do something for the whole. And that, in terms of karma yoga, I thought karma yoga is when you offer your action it's an offering for the whole that you are. And out of that reason, doesn't really revolve so much around your personal desires or the desires of the body-mind identified individual, because that is no more.
But karma yoga is actually for somebody who hasn't realized they're the whole.
But isn't it like you try to act as if, and that's why you try to do actions that are only in the higher good, in the good of all people or the whole planet or the whole universe?
No.
So you basically bring your action already in alignment with that which you don't know yet?
I think that's too complicated. I think that knowledge rests much more simply than that. You know, for in this way, with your knowledge, you recognize all of this as Ishvara. Okay? And you, here you are. So this is Ishvara. This rug is Ishvara. The air is Ishvara. The walls are Ishvara. Everybody here is Ishvara. The whole thing is Ishvara. Okay. Now, I don't have to behave in any particular way in terms of my thinking that I'm giving things, doing something for Ishvara. That's already a given. And so that being a given, right, that's a given for the mind. So there's no... There's no one having to say those type of things. It's all just much more simple knowing. Now, with karma yoga, that is a practice that also becomes habitual. But I'm talking about the karma yoga as Lord Krishna teaches it in the Bhagavad Gita. That's where I have the freedom to follow my desires, fulfill my desires with an attitude that keeps me in relationship to the Lord, right, and allows me to accept all of the results of these actions as prasad from the Lord. For the jnani, there's no doership there. That whole thing is really not taking place. And so until that absolute sannyasa buddhi is there, where I just recognize all of this as Ishvara, right? I'm Ishvara, everything is Ishvara. I don't have desires like that. So until that's the case, then I'm free to live out those desires. And Krishna talks about it in the Bhagavad Gita, that that is what is the healthy thing to do. That's what the correct thing to do is to live in the world, you know, and do those and fulfill your desires with that particular attitude as you're gaining knowledge, you know. And don't try to kind of suppress the mind or put crimps on the mind to stop it from kind of doing what it needs to do to fulfill itself. Go ahead and do that in the light of your knowledge with that attitude, and things will basically take care of themselves, which they do. You know? And what's interesting, it's all very subtle in a way, because even once you do gain knowledge, and all of this is Ishvara, you will still be following your desires because of the prarabdha karma. It's just that that's not a problem inside.
So, Carol, is it considered part of prarabdha karma when you become a moksha, when you gain knowledge as well? Is that considered part of prarabdha?
Well, I don't know quite how they... let me say how I've heard it around that. That to gain knowledge and to come into contact with your guru is considered huge punya, crores and crores, lifetimes and lifetimes of punya. In fact, in the Viveka Chudamani, in your first verses, they talk about that. And just in the tradition, there will always, in most of the Upanishads, at the beginning of the Upanishad, there'll be some verses that really praise the mumukshu, the person who desires liberation, right, as being somebody very, very rare, and that Viveka, that discrimination, you know, the viveka, the discrimination and the vairagya, the dispassion and the desire for liberation happen to be there in a person that's not ordinary. This is samsara. This universe is meant to be a bogey, and, you know, a samsari and an enjoyer of the universe, not for somebody to sit back and say, no, wait a minute, this isn't working. Is there any way out? What's the truth of all of this? There's not very many people who do that, right? And so it takes a lot of punya, they say, to come to that point. And that punya will be reflected in the chart. In other words, it will be reflected in your chart, the astrology for, you know, that if they'll look at the chart and see that, and that it would be, it's in the chart that you would meet your teacher, that type of thing. But whether or not you make use of that, you know, hopefully you'll make use of that opportunity, you know. But, yeah. So there's some free will there too, but it should be there in the chart.
Yeah. But it's not like inevitable progression in every jiva's life at
no.
point.
No, it's not, except that it's not, there's infinite number of jivas and we can be here for an awfully long time. I just think for ourselves, okay, lucky enough to be mumukshas and gain knowledge. Now, how long has it taken you? When we look at the beginningless creation, we've been around for a long time, you know, according to that tradition. It can go on. It's not as though the Vedanta, the Upanishads, don't accept you call it like an evolution, as though you're climbing up an evolutionary ladder. And, you know, last life you were a little less evolved than this life, and now at this you've come, you're an old soul, and here you are, this, you know.
So it's not like that.
It's not.
You can screw up at any time.
Yes, you can screw up at any time. Ups and downs. But at some point, you assimilate your experience to make you then seek this knowledge. And then in the tradition, in the Bhagavad Gita also, it says, you know, at that point, even if you say you lose your life, before you gain this knowledge, you'll be reunited with it in the next life. Because once those questions are there, they're not going to go away. You know, that's already there's an ignorance that's being removed in the recognition of the problem itself. That this world is not capable of giving you anything lasting. And we're not seeking just temporary moments of happiness. We're seeking something which is stable, you know.
I was just thinking, I mean, doesn't this make sort of the era that we're living in pretty special? Because it looks like, you know, the planet keeps going like this. there will not be any human race in 50 years from now. By the blown piece of the poison ourselves, or nature that takes care of it. So there's only a certain amount of time left for humanity to.
Well, if we that's true for this planet, it does not look like if we're not doing well. That's for sure. Yeah, it's very dangerous. So hopefully we can save it.
But you have to find a life form in a different galaxy somewhere that is.
Yeah, but Thomas, this isn't going to be your responsibility. Ishwara will take care of it. You're not going to have to worry about that as a jiva. And the creation is looked at as something which is cyclical and multi-dimensional, many different layers, many different lokas or spheres of reality, many different places where the soul will go, you know, to exhaust karma when this body drops. And this is one tiny little planet in this particular loka, right? It's one planet of countless planets. And so to think that, and this isn't Vedanta now, but to maybe just think that as though this is the only planet that has any life on it is kind of strange. But even if you look at from a Vedantic standpoint or the Upanishads, you know, the universe is cyclical. It's multidimensional and it's cyclical and it's beginningless. And so even if this was the only one single planet in this infinite universe where there was life in this particular plane of reality, you know, it'll have to just wait for the next cycle.
Well, I was thinking more along the lines of if you're brought up in central China under Mao, you will have a hard time when you come to America and have to adjust to this. So if we, whatever, die because humanity is erased, then in some other galaxy that has a totally different life form.
But no, listen. I'm going to go there with one more sentence and then I'm going to go there. Go ahead.
I mean, it's very creative, though. I have two questions. The first question is, like, doesn't being dharmic lead up to the same place as doing your action offering the actions up to the Lord Krishna or Lord and expecting the prasad to be what it is?
Yeah, dharma.
Dharmic and the similar in
the yeah, dharma, the practice of dharma also, now with that, it's a different type of, we don't exactly call that karma yoga, but when you're doing just your actions for dharma, but not, say, to gain, a heaven world or a particular anything else, you're doing all of your actions for the sake of antakarana shuddhi, for the sake of purity of mind, not for pleasure, not for a better next life, nothing like that.
Just in a peaceful mind.
For purity of mind. That's why you do that. And then a person who's committed to dharma, that's the beautiful reward of dharma also. But that's also considered a sadhana for gaining antakarana shuddhi, purity of mind. And that mind that has some peace is available for this knowledge. That's why I say even you do that dharma, but you also say you have some desires. You still do the desires and you don't become a dharmic because you're fulfilling the desires. You do the dharma, what is your dharma to be done, and you fulfill the desires, taking everything as prasad from the Lord. That gives you a peaceful mind that's then available for this knowledge, right? This mind has to be something that can gain this knowledge, because the knowledge is taking place through words. There's an unfoldment going on, right? But your mind is worried about this and worried about that and worried about that, so it can't hear, right? So a peaceful mind can just be focused, and it's not even focused. It just can abide and listen and understand and question. It's available for it. that requires a certain equipoise of mind, peace of mind. And you can get that through the practice of Dharma, as well as through that Karma Yoga.
And the other one was, thank you very much, and then the other one was, what is it one can do to speed this up? I know the answer already, but I want to hear it. Do you know what I mean? Sometimes I feel very passionate about the teaching, you know, I go, man, incredible. And sometimes I don't know. But what are the times that I feel very passionate? What can I do? Meaning the other trips I was in, you could fast for a week or a month or so, something like that.
You know what I think there's two things. You do as much shravana exposure to that teaching as is comfortable for you, because you don't want to burn your mind out either. So whatever as much as is comfortable for you, and you are kind to your mind. You learn to be compassionate and a good friend to your mind, because that is what gives the mind the most shanti and the most peace. And expose yourself to the teaching as much as possible so you can get that clarity. Because the mind has questions and it has vagueness and it yearns to have that vagueness resolved. Yeah. And it keeps you on track also.
Yeah.
Every time you come to class, it just wipes away all the samsara,
yeah.
Cleans the slate, and then you go out into it again. You build up strength, the strength of knowledge, yeah.
Teacher or teaching from India, where what I heard was that anger, of all the enemies that we have, anger is the greatest enemy, Krodha. So that kind of gets back to where that question was, which is in the practice of this or Karma Yoga, you know, what gets us closer to realization or in this Antakarana Shuddhi. Is there a different,
Well, see, with Krodha, with anger really, if you really analyze it in yourself and you get angry, there's something usually has hurt you. Right? That's usually a response to a hurt. And so when you get angry, you don't want to beat yourself up over the getting angry. You want to go inside and find out what is really hurting you. Just like if a friend became very upset and angry, you're not going to attack the person, hopefully, for being upset and angry. You're going to wait for them to calm down, probably.
Yeah.
And then try to understand, you know, what is it? What's going on?
Well, it seems like it's often you have a desire. Something blocks you from that desire.
Yeah.
As simple as a common everyday occurrence, you're in traffic. Suddenly somebody cuts you off. You're angry.
Yeah.
And
well, to me, that type of anger is kind of like Swamiji's lights blowing up and the matches blowing up. If you have some road rage or something like that, you know, you should say, wow, that's interesting, you know, and see what that's about. But I wouldn't get too hung up on it.
Going back to wherever that, I'm sorry, I'm not very good at quoting scripture at this point, but that if anger indeed is the greatest enemy, and I would definitely classify anger as being between raga and vesha.
Well, it's in the verse. It's really anger is an effect of kama krodha, right? And it comes from ajnanam, ignorance. Ajnanam and then kama then krodha, I think it goes.
Yeah.
And so the thing is, once you understand that the anger is maybe has its cause in desire, okay, if you want to go that route, then you understand that. And so when you get angry, then you can be self-reflective and look at what led to it. And then you can bring your knowledge in and your understanding in, you know, and help your mind to gain clarity. What I'm trying to emphasize that I think is so important is that until you're really a jnani, that your knowledge is really clear, there are reasons for you to get angry. Right? And the reason is self-ignorance. And the self-ignorance, what that does is it makes you believe, really believe, that your well-being is dependent on something, on that. You believe that. And then some jerk comes along and gets in the way of it. And it's irritating. Right? It's maddening. You get lost. But once you start understanding yourself, that you're not thrown off so much like that. And then if you are thrown off, you become interested in that. And just like the match is exploding, it's like, that's something that you probably want to work on, because it's upsetting for others and it's upsetting for you. When you get angry, it upsets everybody, including you. So that's probably something you want to understand. It all comes down to knowledge and to understanding. And knowledge and love are very, knowledge, love, understanding, they're all very connected with each other. You know, it's without that kind of love or well-being, it's hard to even be in a space to know or to understand, because you're already in another space of being angry or upset or hurt. So that type of mind can't know anything. Somebody has to come, the buddhi has to, that's all manas then. It's the kind of agitated mind. Then your buddhi, the one that knows, has to come in. You know? And so how is it going to come in? Is it going to come in like a superego? You know, kind of a, you know. Or is it, does it have some knowledge and wisdom? And what we're trying to do is get the buddhi, you know, properly situated so that it can bring knowledge and wisdom into the situation to help you. Yeah.
I'm sorry, but like I just have been listening to news, and recently I had an experience of part of a training, because I take care of elderly people. I was told I ended up working in assisted, you know, it's for elderly people, a home for people that are, and so basically I found myself around people who were dying, but people who were taking care of them were, they generally, this is the situation, it's common now, in these homes where the elderly are taken care of, they are giving many people, the people taking care of them have way too many people to take care of. So they themselves become injured, and the people they're taking care of get neglected. So I've been going through 4 weeks of this training, feeling increasingly angry at this whole situation, and the story of the Buddha came to mind, which is, you know, what woke up the Buddha was not maybe the contrast between the two, that he lived this life of privilege, and then suddenly,
you saw the other side.
And I felt a little bit.
Well, that's like, you know, if we, like if this were Swargaloka and everything you possibly desired, you had a perfect body, you know, and everything you desired was given to you immediately, you might not think about it. You're just having a great time. You know, but the universe does provide us with the opposite. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think that story of the Buddha is kind of like that. His father tried to give him just a perfect life so that he never had to think about sorrow or pain or grief, anything that would make him question or become a sannyasi. Tried to keep all of that away from him, you know, so that it wouldn't occur to him that there was anything wrong that had to be corrected. Right, if everything's just going perfectly all the time, there's nothing wrong that needs to be corrected. why become a sannyasi? What is that about? Nothing. But when you start seeing all of the opposites, then you start, you know, wondering. Tell.
Would there be sort of a middle ground, you know, between the practice of karma yoga and when you actually, you know, are abiding in the self, of kind of remembering the self? In other words, I ask that because sometimes these kinds of like skillful practices of karma yoga or something, or even like doing japa or something like that, while I can see can be helpful, particularly if you're very agitated or something, they often seem, it seems kind of artificial.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas, you know, more just remembering what we learned here in the midst of our daily lives seems like a more...
That's all true.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but if you have a desire, how do you handle that? Do you just try to remember the self so that you thwart the desire? I'm talking about desires
right.
that are not there to be thwarted, but mm-hmm. things that you really want and things that you really need. How to be with that?
Mm-hmm.
That's where karma yoga comes in. The other, that's just a matter of course. It's just you remember your knowledge, you remember yourself, and that takes care of so many things,
mm-hmm.
right? But then there's the things that you want to do that are important to you, that have a grip on you. I'm talking about that. And I'm saying, don't try to not do that. You can bring in your knowledge to try to mitigate the tension that causes, you know, but you can still go ahead to fulfill the desire, just take the results as prasad from the Lord, and that itself gives you a lot of freedom. So all of these things are at play, not just one.
The point, though, I guess, is not to kind of suppress your desire.
Absolutely.
And in the name of, you know, some
spiritual
truth or something, therefore I don't really need that or want that, when in fact you really do want it.
That's exactly right.
But it's so easy to fall into that trap, though, especially, you know, with the practice. I feel like even with the practice of having a friend, because, you know, oftentimes you have really put emphasis on saying that, you know, be kind to your mind, even when, you know, you're angry or you're upset or whatever. But even that sometimes, you know, in practice it seems like, okay, I am already upset or angry, and then it seems easier to say, okay, I'm upset or angry, just let that be, as opposed to saying, okay, now let me bring in, you know, let me remember this practice that seems not to say.
If you do it naturally, you don't have to remember it, right? Like what you just said is itself being kind to your mind. In other words, say you're already approaching your mind in a way that is not mean to the mind. Say if you're upset or angry,
right.
and so what you're saying without even saying, because you don't need to say, because it's just what you do, it's all right, I'm upset or angry, let that be.
Mm-hmm.
That's the buddhi right there. I like that. That's a nice buddhi. Do you see that?
So you're saying that in that instance, then you don't...
You're already doing it.
Mm-hmm.
It's not like you have to conjure something up. It's You only have to conjure something up is... if you're not doing that. Like, there's so many people have a very critical voice. Like, say you're upset or angry. You can have a voice that comes in, oh no, there you are, upset or angry again. And then become very critical of the person who's upset or angry.
Right.
Haven't you learned anything better? You know? That doesn't help. You're bringing in just your knowledge. All right, you're upset or angry. That's okay. You'll get over it. You know, that's a supportive way of holding it. So you're already doing it. You don't need to now go and do something else.
Mm-hmm.
But you would need to if the way you were holding that was critical or judgmental or something that made the situation worse.
But what if the buddhi wasn't, you know, it's not that there is a critical part of you, but what if it does? Actually, never mind, I'll retract that question. I don't really have that question.
And also, you know, there's a difference between being, when I say being critical, I don't mean constructive criticism.
Mm-hmm.
I mean that negative force. Constructive criticism is useful. You're trying to help. There's not cruelty there. But we can, depending upon what type of family you had and whatnot, you can have some really negative interjects.
But
then there's somebody there who's being kind to that negative introject. See, if you can say, all right, there's a negative introject there, you're accommodating them. That's the buddhi. The negative introject now is no longer in control. Do you see that?
Yeah.
That's really important. And that's what we want to do with those negative introjects, is to allow them to be and to talk with them or to whatever we do. But they're not the buddhi now. That's perfect.
That's right, but yeah. I think what you were saying before, you know, I have the same kind of confusion about, really, you know, sometimes you're not even aware that you are suppressing something that you feel that, you know, your knowledge mandates that, or not mandates, your knowledge would imply that your mind behave a certain way, that you're able to accommodate it. And so you pretend like you are, at least for me, you know, that is my confusion, is that I may pretend I'm accommodating it without even realizing that there is a suppression, you know, without realizing that there is a suppression of emotion.
You'll eventually realize it. You may not realize it at the moment, but you will, because it will be causing you pain. Yeah, it'll be uncomfortable. Yeah. Okay, let's stop.